WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The play and movie Amadeus were very popular and introduced Mozart's music to new audiences. But as music history, they weren't very accurate. My guest has often been called upon to set the record straight. H.C. Robbins Landon is one of the world's leading musicologists. He's the author of several books about Mozart, including 1791, about Mozart's last year, and a new book called Mozart, The Golden Years, about the last decade of Mozart's life. Landon is also an authority on Haydn and is considered the man most responsible for the recent revival of Haydn's work. He founded the Haydn Society in 1949. Landon lives in the southwest of France, but he's American-born and is currently visiting the States. I asked him why he thinks Mozart is the greatest composer in history.
Well, when I was 13, I thought this too, but in those days they thought I was mad because everybody knew that Mozart wasn't the greatest composer. Bach, Beethoven, Wagner, and so on. But I didn't believe this. I thought that it was Mozart. And although there are many things I didn't understand at the age of 13, I did understand one thing. I didn't know what the word meant, but if I'd been able to express it, it's the word ambivalence. Nowadays, where the world is about to blow up in front of us, many people don't think that the great positive answer of Beethoven is the answer. Think of this Fifth Symphony, when it starts out with this tremendous questioning C minor, but it all ends well in C major. Well, Mozart doesn't end well. The Symphony G minor doesn't end well. The C minor piano concerto K491 doesn't end well. And I should think for many people, this rather more subtle questioning of the universe is perhaps more in tune with the times than other people's music. I am not, you understand, disparaging Wagner and Beethoven, or Bach. That would be too stupid, because it's all part of God's cosmos, as Haydn would have said. But nevertheless, I think there is a case that people certainly have more need of Mozart than they ever did before.
I think a lot of people's knowledge of Mozart is based on the movie or the play Amadeus from the Peter Schaeffer story. And you say that a lot of the information that's in there is really pure myth. So why don't we start there before we get any further? Was Mozart really a lout who laughed a lot and was very obnoxious and not worthy of the talent that he had?
Well, it's not a view to which I subscribe, obviously, and it's not a view that you would be able to find in any of the 18th century sources that I've studied. But, you know, I must say this about Amadeus. Everybody's always accusing Amadeus of being a wrong description of Mozart's life, but Schaffer and the great movie is not supposed to be a biography of Mozart. It's supposed to be a biography of Salieri, mediocrity, and jealousy. And this is particularly the case with Miklos Forman's movie. So I think, in a sense, we're doing them an injustice if we try to imagine that that's the way they think Mozart was like. They're making a point, aren't they? They're making a point with the cultivated and subtle and rather devious Salieri, and in order to make it stand out more strongly from their particular scenario, they're making Mozart out to be much more loutish and boorish than he obviously ever was. So, no, he certainly wasn't that way. On the contrary, look, if you'll forgive my putting it this way, a courtier, and Mozart was a courtier. He was a member of a huge international court that spoke 15 languages at least. And in the movie, certainly, Constanze would not have been presented to the Emperor Joseph II with a décolleté that practically revealed her nipples. I mean, that one, he would have lasted just 5 minutes. And this is the kind of thing, of course, that really exasperates people who know about the 18th century, because this is not the way it worked at all. You wouldn't do that now if you were being presented to the Queen in England. I mean, it was never enter anybody's head. Well, it wouldn't have entered their head either. You see, so once you start having these liberties, it's like the thin edge of the wedge. Pretty soon the wedge is more important than anything else.
Now, did Salieri poison Mozart, as the movie and the play Amadeus?
Certainly not. You couldn't poison people in late 18th century Vienna. They had doctors examining the corpses. Nobody got put in the grave without there being a medical man come from the city of Vienna examining the corpse, particularly if the corpse was swollen as Mozart was, or if he didn't die of obvious old age.
What did he die of?
Well, the latest, mind you, I'm not qualified to discuss that, so I have to rely on the opinions of others. And the latest medical opinion, which is causing a great deal of interest, is by an Australian doctor called Dr. Peter Davis, who has analyzed Mozart's last illness. And I'm putting it, it's very brief. Mozart had a kidney ailment known as the Schönlein-Henoch syndrome, which was unidentifiable in the 18th century. So they couldn't have known how to treat it, even if they'd wanted to. And in the end result, this went into a series of chain reactions, which ended up by Mozart's whole body being swollen up with moisture, hence the bloodletting. They wanted to get the pressure off the heart. And what happened was an enormous collapse of the nervous system and heart failure. And that is a result of this kidney illness. That, probably, if there are any doctors listening, they're throwing their hands up in horror. But this is basically what Dr. Davis is saying.
H.C. Robbins-Landon is my guest. He's one of the world's experts on Mozart and Haydn. And his new book about Mozart is called Mozart, The Golden Years. You say that you think Mozart was manic depressive, that he suffered from terrible mood swings, and that those mood swings are reflected in the music.
Well, this is, again, that distinguished Dr. Davis, whom I've never met, by the way, the Australian doctor's theory that Mozart was a manic depressive, and he quotes a lot of contemporary reports by Mozart's friends, sister-in-law, which he says are absolutely clinically typical of a manic depressive, and people who have a kind of psychomatic nervous disorder, when they're up, they're very, very up, and when they're down, they're absolutely desperate. The difference is between all of us who have ups and downs is that we don't write the C minor concerto when we're down, and Mozart did. And if you examine the pattern of these really far-out and violent works, or indeed works of extreme that show extreme pressure, where in some cases even the manuscript shows great pressure, like that of the C minor concerto. Well, if you add them all up, as I tried to do in this book in a kind of a little graph, you could see there is a kind of pattern, because the highs of a man like that can last many months, and the lows can last 5 days. But 5 days is enough if you're writing at Mozart speed to turn off the C minor piano concerto and leave an ink blot on history.
Well, you're talking about the C minor piano concerto. I want to play an excerpt of the Symphony No. 40 in G minor. Do you think that this is an example of...
Absolutely. It's one of the classic examples of all Mozart of violent disorder. Mm-hmm. Particularly, well, the first movement and the last movement, in the middle of the last movement, we even get the 12-note scale, 11 of the 12-note scale thrown at us. Ta-da-pa-pa-pa-pee-dee-pa-pum-pum-ta-da-dum-pum-beam-pum. I mean, this is nervous of the violent disorder in an orderly system of notes, which hardly had ever been expressed like that before.
What about the beginning of the first movement?
Well, the beginning is also with these divided violas. There's a sense of anguish and a sense of frustration and restlessness. What do you suppose they thought of that symphony when they first heard it?
Let's hear it now. What did they think about that when they first heard it?
Well, we don't know, because we have no contemporary newspapers. It's not like London, where when Haydn was there 2 years later, we sometimes have 5 daily newspaper reports the next day what everybody thought about the concert. We don't know what they thought about Mozart's concerts. We don't have, except for an occasional diary, we don't have a single report about any of these concerts that Mozart played in. We don't even know how the orchestra was set up, how many were in the orchestra, where the piano was placed. Our ignorance is absolutely bottomless.
We know, we just heard an excerpt of the recording of Franz Bruggen conducting the orchestra of the 18th century in the Symphony No. 40. I'm wondering what you think of the period instrument movement, which Franz Bruggen is one of the leaders of.
Well, I think it's absolutely essential for us to know what Mozart's orchestra sounded like, what the piano's concerto sounded like with an 18th century piano or reproduction thereof. Malcolm Bilson, as you know, has now recorded all of them, conducted by John Elliott Gardiner, and they're just absolute revelations. I mean, this is obviously, we have to know how this sounded in order to make sense out of the music. Now, this doesn't mean that next time we hear Muti conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra in a huge hall that he's going to try to do it with a forte piano, because you wouldn't hear it. There are real problems about trying to turn 18th century sound into 20th century realism and exigencies, and I don't think it would be both foolish and very ill-advised if we forced every orchestra to have a sort of a whole second section of its only original instruments, so that when they marched out to start the evening with Mozart or Haydn, that they had one set, and then they all changed into their 19th century garb for the rest of it. It's not on.
I'm really interested in hearing what it was like to be a court composer. What were the official positions Mozart held within the court in Vienna where he lived?
Well, he finally got a position with the Emperor Joseph II at the end of 1787 for 800 gulden a month. This was not a very bad salary. It wasn't a brilliant salary, but it was bad. It was what, for instance, somebody who was in charge of the castle of the Belvedere, which is one of the court's official Viennese castles, got too. Haydn got 1,000 gulden, but of course Haydn was much older. The biggest position in Vienna, which Mozart was going to get, was that of cathedral chapel master, and that he was waiting for the president incumbent to die, but the president incumbent, Leopold Hoffmann, lived on until 1793. If Mozart had got that job, and he would have, that would have been 2,000 gulden and all sorts of perks such as free firewood, free candles, half a pig, and so on. Now, at the court, what Mozart was expected to do was simply to compose music. They really gave him the job by default because they didn't want him, as it were, in real financial trouble, and people saying, how is it possible a Viennese court doesn't take care of somebody like that? This we know because of a document after Mozart died where they said they gave him the job mainly because they thought it would be too embarrassing to have him have to go elsewhere to get one. So they didn't really know quite what to do with Mozart officially, so he ended up writing a huge quantity of dance music, which turned out to be the greatest and finest dance music written before Johann Strauss, but it was in a sense a terrible waste of his talents. What he should have been doing is writing Italian opera and German opera and so on. Now, Mozart had to be very well dressed. His wife Constanze had to be well dressed. They had to represent the court, and this was one of the troubles, that they had to live at a rather high level of just be day-to-day existence because they appeared so much in public, which meant they had to have beautiful clothes, and clothes were very expensive. And since Mozart was rather scatterbrained in his dealing with money, not Constanze, she was much better, but he obviously didn't care, and he was very generous. Like many artists, they really didn't interest him very much. So that it wasn't until 1791, after five rather lean years, when the public withdrew its support, nobody knows quite why, of Mozart's subscription concerts, that in 1791 Mozart was able to begin to get his finances back into shape again, and all he needed to have done was just live a little longer. He would have had no problems whatever. If he lived just two more years, no problems.
Mozart's last opera, one of his last pieces, was The Magic Flute. And you talk in your books about there's how much there is from the Masons that shows up in the music of The Magic Flute. Mozart had joined the Masons.
1784, yes.
Yeah, so that was about 7 years before his death. What were the Masons like then? And then we could talk about how he incorporated them musically into the Magic Flute.
Well, the Masons were an organization, a charitable organization, dedicated really to the proposition of the Enlightenment. In other words, freedom, all men are brothers, freedom of politics. They were against despots. Of course, they were behind the French Revolution. They were behind the American Revolution. Washington was a master Mason. So was Franklin, Jefferson, Adams. The whole lot of them were Masons. The Declaration of Independence reads in many respects like a Masonic document, and so does the Bill of Bill of Rights. Now, Mozart, who was a passionate Mason, by 1791 began to think, along with his friend and librettist, also a fellow Mason, Emanuel Schikaneder, that Masonry was in serious trouble, and it was. The reason for that being that the Austrian court thought with some justification that the Austrian Masons would rather like to overthrow the monarchy and substitute a republican government. This certainly, many Masons, was a thought that they entertained. And there was a big Freemasons conspiracy that my clever wife uncovered in the Viennese archives of 1791 that's published in this new book, The Golden Years, which shows that the Austrian government did have a certain amount of reason to worry about the Masons. And in fact, by 1793, the Masons were practically out of existence. And by 1795, they were banned and remained banned in Austria until 1918. I believe that what Mozart and Schikaneder were trying to do was to salvage Masonry by writing a brilliant Masonic opera. One of the symbols in the Magic Flute are three. There are three boys, three flats in the signature. There are three ladies. And, there, of course, there are the famous three chords. Now, one of the Masons' knocks is thump-pum, bum. Bum, 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 bum. Now, this particular set of knocks in the 18th century was for the second grade. There are three grades of masonry. There is the ended apprentice, and then there's a master mason. In between times, there is a second degree called fellow craft. And this knock represented the fellow craft or second degree in the 18th century in Austria. And the reason for that was that Tamino, who is, as it were, symbolic of the Masons, cannot yet be a master mason because he hasn't undergone his rituals and his purification of fire and water, which happens towards the end of the opera, remember? So at the beginning, when Mozart starts to show you that it's a Masonic opera, he does it right away in the middle of the overture. He stops the music dead, and in come these three Mason calls, which every Mason in the audience will have recognized, perhaps with a certain frisson.
Let's listen to those chords that you're talking about. This is in the middle of the overture from the Magic Flute. Well, shortly after the Magic Flute was written, the Masons were banned in Austria till 1918. Was the Magic Flute banned as well?
Well, they couldn't do that because the Magic Flute was circulated all over Central Europe by then. It was a huge international, from the standpoint of the German-speaking countries, hit. So they tried two things. They tried to put out a pamphlet in which they tried to rewrite the message of the Magic Flute, and Masonry is nowhere even mentioned. And then a year later, that was in 1794, in 1795, they got out another party line, how you ought, as a proper, sensible Austrian, to regard the Magic Flute. And these two particular documents I've published for the first time in English as appendices, short and abbreviated, because they go on and on and on, in my golden years, because I thought it would be interesting to see how a police state tries to deal, even in the late 18th century, with these problems.
You've devoted a lot of your career to publishing the unpublished work of Haydn, and also to changing his status from a second-rate composer to an important composer. What made you gravitate toward his music and spend so much of your life with it?
Well, when I was 13, I was at Asheville School in North Carolina. Thomas Wolfe, not Tom. Thomas Wolfe.
Yes.
And I had an amazing music teacher there called Matthias Cooper. And I said to him, I said, Professor Cooper, I would love to devote my life to music. What should I do? And he said, well, I don't really think you're going to knock Horowitz off the concert platform. I don't think this is going to be your thing. I think you ought to do something about Haydn. And I said, why should I do something about Haydn? And he said, because there's no Gesamtausgabe of Haydn. I said, what's a Gesamtausgabe? And he said, Opera Omnia, all the works, like Mozart and Beethoven. I said, Professor, you mean all the other composers like Mozart, Beethoven, Bach have complete editions, collected editions? He said, yes. I said, but how come Haydn doesn't have one? He said, well, that's a long story, and it's because much of his music is owned privately by princes who live in out-of-the-way places in Central Europe. And we don't even know how much Haydn wrote. There's no catalog of his music, and nine-tenths of what we believe he wrote is still unpublished. So then he played me a recording of Symphony No. 93, brand new in those days, this is 1939, by Sir Thomas Beecham. And I listened to this amazing symphony, and I said, Professor Cooper, you mean there are 104 symphonies like that? And he said, yes, more or less. I said, but they're crazy. He said, that's what I'm telling you. So I said, how do I go about doing this? He said, you've got to learn the tricks of the trade. You mustn't just take a liberal arts education. That won't do you any good. You've got to go to a conservatory as well. So I went, I ended up at Boston University, which was both a university and a conservatory. It had Carl Geiringer, the great Haydn expert, and who wrote written books on Brahms and musical instruments. And I went to study with him because he was the only Haydn expert in this country. And I learned all the tricks of the trade at the conservatory, harmony and carnival and so forth. And in 1947, when I was finished, I shot off to Europe to try to get to grips with the original sources. And with interruptions, I've been there ever since.
Are you surprised you take it for granted that the stock of certain composers goes up and down over the years, over the centuries?
Over the centuries, no, because that's the natural processes of the time, the Great Reaper. Vivaldi is, of course, the classic case. Vivaldi is still number one on the best-selling CD in England, and it's also number seven, another recording. And it's gone on that way, week after week after week after week. Displaced for a year, you will be fascinated to hear by the Elgar Cello Concerto, also in two different recordings. This is a phenomenon I think is absolutely weird. It's not that I don't like the Elgar Cello Concerto, but why this introspective, brooding, melancholy piece that have become a bestseller is it must mean that people need that kind of music, isn't it? It must mean also they need Vivaldi as a kind of music, and it must mean now that Mozart has become, as it were, the most popular composer in 1989, it must mean they need Mozart. Well, when they don't need Mozart, it's obviously, for instance, 100 years ago, they needed him a lot less. They needed heroic music in the 19th century, didn't they? Well, now, as I said at the beginning of this program, they need maybe less heroic music. And as for the ups and downs, you know, George Sell used to tell me, he said, Robert, you know, the musicologists think they influence public opinion, but you know they don't. The public knows exactly. It's made up its mind which of the Haydn symphonies it wants to hear, and it's more or less the 12 we all play, and that you are not going to make them change their mind and substitute a different 12 because they like these better, and on the whole their choice is right. I think there is something to be said for Vox Dei, Vox Publicum, Vox Dei, and I should think moreover that all you can do is what I did in the case of Haydn, where they didn't have any choice because a lot of the stuff wasn't published, was to get it all published, and the public is then going to make up its mind what they want to hear in the future and what they don't want to hear.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.